Good morning and welcome to today's edition of Times the Brief, brought to you by Spoken Layer. I'm Harvey Kojan, and these are the top stories of the day. Times the Brief is supported by Squarespace, providing tools for creative individuals and business owners to make a website. Squarespace includes hosting, e-commerce, and 24/7 customer care. Learn more at squarespace.com/thebrief. Conservative billionaire Charles Koch told his ultra-rich friends that they face a life-and-death decision whether to keep lobbying for tax breaks and government subsidies. Business leaders must recognize that their behavior is suicide, that it is suicide long-term. To survive long-term, they have to start opposing rather than promoting corporate welfare, Koch told about 450 allies at an Orange County, California summit that began Saturday. With the Pacific Ocean behind him and friendly CEOs sipping wine nearby, one of the biggest political donors in the country said it is time for conservatives to start eschewing tax breaks. Obviously, this prescription will not be an easy pill for many business people to swallow, because short-term, taking the principled path is going to cost some companies some profits, as it will for Koch Industries, the 79-year-old Koch said. But long-term, it will allow business people to continue to own and run their businesses, which none of us will be able to do, in my view, in the future otherwise. He pointed to big banks that took virtually free money from the Fed and bailouts in exchange for regulations. Now, the chickens are coming home to roost, Koch said. The Fed is taking control of these banks. The Fed now decides what businesses they can be in and how they run those businesses. Koch said regulators, auditors, controllers are implanted at the banks to keep tabs. The banks, Koch argued, end up making political donations to avoid too much oversight. Koch warned that other businesses would be next if their leaders continue taking government subsidies. This means stopping the subsidies, mandates, and special privileges for business that enriches the haves at the expense of the have-nots, Koch said. It's that class distinction that Koch has made the focus of seminars at the luxurious resort. In my view, we're heading toward a two-tiered society, a society that is destroying opportunities for the disadvantaged and creating welfare for the rich, Koch said. Misguided policies are creating a permanent underclass, crippling our economy and corrupting the business community, present company excepted, of course. But what this is doing, then, is turning more and more Americans against what they mistakenly believe is free enterprise. With his brother David, Koch is among the most powerful players in Republican politics by virtue of their wealth. Forbes estimates he and his brother is each worth $40 billion. They are tied for number 4 on Forbes' rankings of the richest Americans. Koch's opinions shape opinions among rank-and-file conservatives and congressional leaders alike. In fact, 5 White House hopefuls plan to cycle through the 3-day summit in Dana Point, California. At least 14 members of Congress or governors were on hand as well, and former Indiana Governor Mitch Daniels was set to hold a private salon about campus speech later Saturday. Koch's stinging words came as the allies who support the Koch-backed network of social and political groups mingled with like-minded leaders. The Koch-backed network plans to spend $889 million ahead of the 2016 elections, although officials are quick to point out not all of that is explicitly political. Some of it, advisors say, will be spent pushing against what Koch sees as unjustifiable corporate welfare. This article posted by Philip Elliott in Dana Point, California. When dawn breaks in Calais, France, Nabil Idris's hopes are momentarily dampened. Another night has passed, and the 29-year-old has still not managed to reach England. As the sun rises, he begins his 3-hour walk back to the dusty scrubland on the outskirts of Calais, to the makeshift camps known as the jungle to its 3,000 residents. Idris has already ended up staying much longer than he imagined, but he refuses to call it home. A brother, a son, a student, a citizen, Idris had once been many things to many people. But like everyone else in the jungle, he now holds only the deracinated, dispossessed status of the migrant. "It is not a good life here. It is not good at all," he says, picking at a yellowing wound on his shin, the souvenir of an attempt to scale the barbed wire fencing that surrounds the port. Idris left his family behind in the Eritrean capital of Asmara nearly a year ago, fleeing the country's compulsory lifelong military service. Eritrea's repressive government scores lower on political and press freedom rankings than even North Korea. Idris has crossed the sweltering expanse of the Sahara, made a perilous sea journey across the Mediterranean from Libya to Italy, and arrived in the French port city of Calais in the freezing depths of winter. But more than 6 months on, his quest is not over. Idris shares the determination of countless migrants in Calais who are desperate to escape the squalid conditions of the jungle. Fueled by the belief that a better life awaits them on the other side of the channel, they see their situation as temporary. They are drawn to England because they speak the language, have relatives and friends who have settled there, or believe the job market will be better than in France. Others feel differently. Many end up applying for asylum in France, giving themselves a time frame by which they will give up trying to reach England. Some continue to live in the jungle while they endure the long wait for papers to be processed. As a result, the jungle is becoming a more permanent fixture in the Calais landscape. It sprung up without approval, but it has evolved into a shanty town of sorts, albeit one that falls far below international humanitarian standards. Though France is the world's sixth biggest economy, the jungle on the northern edge of Calais would not pass for a refugee camp in a developing nation. Guidelines from the UN High Commissioner for Refugees recommend a maximum of 20 people using one toilet, but in the jungle, 300 migrants share a single toilet. Piles of garbage attract rats and flies, and the air is thick with the stench of sewage and rotting food. However, locals who volunteer in the jungle say conditions are slowly improving. In January, the French government opened the Jules Ferry Refugee Center, built on a former children's summer camp with space for 120 women and children to sleep. In response to criticism from the UN and aid groups, the French government has begun a $550,000 project to improve the basic infrastructure in the camp. In the last month, streetlights have gone up and faucets providing cold water have been installed. Volunteers say that the camp is bigger than ever before, but also better organized. The government is now more present on the ground here in Calais and works more with the charities now, said Carolyn Wiggins, 54, a longtime volunteer with the city's migrant associations over the 11 years she has lived in Calais. In the last 18 months, she and her husband, Michel, have joined about 20 volunteers as part of the French aid organization Salam. 5 days a week, the couple help to serve 2,000 evening meals at the Jules Ferry Center, where they have noticed a significant uptick in the number of people requiring food. They also collect supplies from the local food bank, including vegetables, fruit, and bread, and distribute them at the encampments twice a week. The medical charity Medicines du Monde has also opened a makeshift hospital in wooden sheds, where staff volunteers offer upwards of 40 consultations a day. Its director of operations, Jean-Francois Corti, told Time that as well as infections caused by the filthy state of the camp, the staff are seeing more and more broken bones as migrants make even riskier attempts to stow away on Britain-bound vehicles. Of course, not all the wounds are visible. In every tent is a story of personal horror, and the psychological effects of the journeys endured by the refugees are all too evident. Mustafa, 27, was training to be a doctor in Khartoum, Sudan, before he fled his country's political turmoil. He is still traumatized by the image of a 15-year-old Syrian girl who died of diabetic shock during their difficult 8-day voyage across the sea from Egypt to Italy. The boat owner told her father that it was a 5-star boat with a doctor, and so he paid $50,000 for the family to cross, he said softly, adding that the smuggler made the family throw the girl's body off the boat when she died. I still see her. I see her in front of my eyes. The women of the jungle are haunted, too, by their vulnerability in a camp where 90% of residents are men. Corti of Medicines Du Monde said there has been a sharp increase in women and children in the camp since last summer, but the Jules Ferry Center has been full for a long time. Those not lucky enough to get a bed there must sleep in the jungle. I am always scared to sleep, said a 22-year-old Eritrean woman who gave her name only as Fiori. Yet, for the most part, people in the jungle prefer to exchange jokes rather than stories of woe. Many of the migrants wearily accept that they will be in Calais longer than they would like. Bored of borders, reads a sign outside of one tent. In the jungle, you can now get your hair cut, get your bike fixed, and even pray in an improvised mosque or church. Some of the more enterprising residents walk to the supermarkets in the center of Calais, stocking up on baguettes, potato chips, and canned goods to hawk for a profit back in the jungle. There are over a dozen pop-up shops selling everything from cell phone SIM cards and cigarettes to whiskey, Red Bull, and Coca-Cola. There are reports of occasional alcohol-fueled scuffles when frustrations spill over, but most people in the camp aren't looking for more trouble. A Nigerian refugee recently set up a makeshift school where volunteers teach French and drawing and play games with the children. At night, people dance to Michael Jackson songs under a disco ball in a makeshift club. In the jungle, life goes on, even as most of the residents vowed to continue their attempts to reach England. Mahmoud, a 22-year-old Sudanese whose entire family was killed by Janjaweed militia, said he will keep trying to cross until he makes it, or dies trying. Friends and family have arrived in England successfully, escaping the squalor that he has endured for 15 months. He refuses to build a more permanent shelter, sleeping under a black plastic tarpaulin propped up by wooden sticks. Scrawled across the outside in white letters are French words that translate to, "This is not a housing solution." This article posted by Naina Bajakal in Calais. The ongoing tensions between the families of the late megastar Whitney Houston and her ex-husband, R&B singer Bobby Brown, erupted Saturday during a memorial service for their daughter, Bobby Christina. Bobby Christina, who dreamed of growing up to achieve fame like her mother, died in hospice care July 26th, about 6 months after she was found face down and unresponsive in a bathtub in her suburban Atlanta townhome. A long-standing rift between families of the young woman's famous mother and father broke out into the open at a memorial service being held for Bobby Christina at the St. James United Methodist Church in Alpharetta. Leola Brown, the sister of Bobby Brown, walked out of the church and spoke to reporters gathered outside. She said she was angry because Pat Houston was speaking at the funeral. Pat Houston is the sister-in-law and former manager of the late Whitney Houston. I told her that Whitney is going to haunt her from the grave, Leola Brown told reporters outside the church. She suggested that the feud between the Houstons and the Browns was far from over. It's just getting started, she said. Bobby Christina's death was grimly similar to the way her megastar mother had died 3 years earlier. Bobby Christina was found in the townhome she shared with Nick Gordon, an orphan 3 years older, whom Houston had raised as her own. Bobby Christina referred to him as her husband. A police report earlier this year described the incident as a drowning, and authorities are investigating her death. Bobby Christina Brown was the only child of Houston and Brown and was raised in the shadow of her famous parents' hugely public life. She appeared alongside the couple in 2005 on the Bravo reality show Being Bobby Brown, which showed her parents fighting, swearing, and making court appearances. She attended award shows with her mother and father, walking red carpets with them, and she sang in Central Park with Houston as adoring fans watched. Bobby Christina was the sole heir of her mother's estate. She identified herself on Twitter as daughter of Queen W.H., entertainer/actress with William and Morrison Company, and, quote, last of a dying breed. She told Oprah Winfrey shortly after her mother's death in 2012 that she wanted to carry on Houston's legacy by singing, acting, and dancing, but her career never took off. The Texas trooper who arrested Sandra Bland after a confrontation that began with a traffic stop was once cautioned about unprofessional conduct in a 2014 incident while he was still a probationary trooper, according to his personnel file. Bland, a 28-year-old Chicago-area woman, was found dead in her Waller County jail cell in Hempstead, about 200 miles south of Dallas, on July 13th, 3 days after her arrest. Officials say she used a plastic bag to hang herself, a finding her family has questioned. Bland's family and others also have criticized Trooper Brian Encinia, who stopped Bland for failing to signal a lane change. The Associated Press obtained Encinia's personnel file Friday from the Texas Department of Public Safety through a Freedom of Information Act request. Encinia has been part of the department for a little over a year. For the most part, his file was unremarkable. He received competent ratings in all of the evaluations that were released. However, in an evaluation that covered September and October 2014, his supervisor noted that Encinia was given a written counseling for unprofessional conduct for an incident occurring while at a school in Austin. The documents provided no additional details, and a Department of Public Safety official did not return a phone call seeking comment Friday night. The evaluation goes on to say, in the future, Trooper Encinia should conduct himself at all times in a manner that will reflect well upon himself, the department, and the state of Texas. This supervisor will ensure that this is done by meeting periodically with Trooper Encinia. Under the category of stress tolerance in the same evaluation, his supervisor remarked that Encinia performed effectively and rationally while involved in a pursuit resulting in a firearms discharge during the reporting period. The document did not provide additional details about that incident. The documents also did not include any information about Encinia's interaction with Bland. That is still under investigation, though the director of the Department of Public Safety, Steve McCraw, has said Encinia violated internal policies of professionalism and courtesy. Dashcam video shows the confrontation between Bland and Encinia swiftly escalated after she objected to being told to put out her cigarette. Encinia, at one point, is seen holding a stun gun as he says, "I will light you up," after Bland refuses to get out of her car. Bland, who is black, eventually was arrested for allegedly assaulting the white trooper. Bland's death came after nearly a year of heightened national scrutiny of police and their dealings with black suspects, especially those who have been killed by officers or who die in police custody. According to his personnel file, Encinia was selected for the Trooper Trainee Academy in December 2013, joined the Department of Public Safety in June 2014 as a probationary trooper, and completed his probation in June 2015, becoming a Highway Patrol trooper. Encinia's most recent performance evaluation was for November and December 2014. Among the remarks were that Encinia appears to operate effectively under stress, continues to use good problem-solving skills and judgment while working patrol, and appears to treat others in a respectful manner. Before applying for trooper training, Encinia was a volunteer firefighter in Brenham, where he was a supervisor at Bluebell Creameries. Brenham Fire Chief Ricky Baker remembered Encinia as a stand-up kind of guy, popular with the people he worked with. Encinia, a 2008 graduate of Texas A&M University, was elected as a district chief, Baker said. He was a smart individual, very detail-oriented, and he was just well-liked by all our members, he said. This article posted by Terry Wallace for the Associated Press. The World Health Organization has asked the IOC to analyze virus levels in Rio de Janeiro's Olympic waters, and the governing body of World Sailing says it will start doing its own independent virus tests. The move comes after an Associated Press investigation showed a serious health risk to Olympic athletes in venues around Rio rife with sewage. In a statement to the AP, the World Health Organization said it suggested the International Olympic Committee start monitoring for viruses at the Rio venues. WHO has also advised the IOC to widen the scientific base of indicators to include viruses, the statement said. The risk assessment should be revised accordingly, pending the results of further analysis. The Rio Local Organizing Committee and the IOC are requested to follow WHO recommendations on treatment of household and hospital waste. A spokesman from the Rio Organizing Committee referred comment to the IOC, which is meeting in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia. Olympic organizers and the Brazilian government have tested only for bacteria to decide if the water is safe. Many experts say viruses are a far bigger problem and need to be monitored. The International Sailing Federation said independently it would start testing for viruses. We're going to find someone who can do the testing for us that can safely cover what we need to know from a virus perspective as well as the bacteria perspective, Peter Sowry, chief executive of the ISF, said. That's my plan. The sailing venue in Guanabara Bay is badly polluted, as is a separate venue for rowing and canoeing, Rodrigo de Freitas Lake in central Rio. The AP investigation also showed venues for triathlon and open water swimming off Copacabana Beach had high virus levels that pose a threat to athletes and tourists. Sowry, who spoke from Kuala Lumpur, has a local interest. His wife, Alessandra, is a native of Rio, and he has a 9-year-old daughter, Marie. I'm a father myself, Sowry said. I want to make sure that everyone who goes out in the water is as safe as possible and is given the right guidance and right security. The AP analysis showed dangerously high levels of viruses and bacteria from sewage in venues where the 1,400 athletes will compete in water sports in the games, which open in a year, August 5, 2016. In Rio, much of the waste and sewage goes untreated and runs down hillside ditches and streams into Olympic water venues that are littered with floating rubbish, household waste, and even dead animals. At the World Swimming Championships in Kazan, Russia, swimmers said they were worried about the situation in Rio. The athletes and the Athletes Commission have expressed their concern at the current problems with the quality of water, the cleanliness of the water, Vladimir Salkinov, a former Olympic gold medal winner, said. That will be put into a recommendation and people will pay attention to that. Shin Atsuka, an executive board member of the International Triathlon Union, said on Friday his body was considering testing for viruses. The ITU is holding an Olympic qualifying race on Sunday using the waters off Copacabana Beach. Costa Rican triathlete Leonardo Chacon said he knows the risks but will take them. We know we are exposed to viruses, maybe to a health problem later, he said on Friday in Rio. But in my case, I have invested so much to prepare myself for this, and I want this to happen because I can't recuperate this investment any other way other than competing and winning the points that I need to win. When Rio was awarded the Olympics in 2009, it promised cleaning its waters would be an Olympic legacy. But Rio Mayor Eduardo Paes has repeatedly acknowledged this will not be done, calling it a lost opportunity. Sowry said the ISAF would start doing its own water testing in Rio this month, no longer relying solely on Brazil's government analysis. We want to make sure we keep pressure on the organizing committee and the Brazilians to make sure they put some energy into cleaning up the bay, Sowry said. My job is to make sure something actually happens and it's not just talk and someone is actually walking the walk. Sowery said he received a call from a woman who wanted reassurance that the ISAF was giving the right guidance to her child and others competing in an Olympic sailing test event this month in Rio. He said a backup plan included sailing all the events outside Guanabara Bay in the open Atlantic. The ISAF has three courses there and three inside the bay. He said it would be heartbreaking to sail outside the bay and lose the postcard backdrop of Sugarloaf Mountain, which will be a focus of television coverage. In most Olympics, sailing is contested far from the main Olympic venues. In Rio, the sailors and rowers and canoeists get center stage, a chance to win fans and valuable sponsors. We're not going to sacrifice health for the sake of good pictures and good TV, he said. But the backdrop of Rio is an amazing backdrop and will do something for the sport of sailing. This article posted by Stephen Wade for the Associated Press in Rio de Janeiro. Angelina Jolie has joined Myanmar's opposition leader and democracy icon Aung San Suu Kyi in sitting down with female workers to learn more about their dire conditions. Jolie, who is a special envoy for the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, is on a four-day visit to the Southeast Asian nation. During her meeting with the factory workers on the outskirts of an industrial zone in Myanmar's largest city, Jolie and Suu Kyi witnessed firsthand the conditions the women live in, mostly low-cost hostels. Jolie also toured inside the factory. She traveled to the state earlier this week, home to more than 10,000 displaced people, since a ceasefire between Myanmar's government and ethnic rebels has broken down in 2011. According to her trip details, it is unlikely that Jolie will be able to travel to western Rakhine State, where more than 100,000 Muslim minority Rohingya live in apartheid-like conditions in camps. It is Jolie's first visit to Myanmar, which only recently emerged from decades of military rule. More than a dozen ethnic minority groups, mostly in Myanmar's border areas, have been fighting for greater autonomy since the country attained independence from Britain 67 years ago. Recently, the world attention has turned to the plight of stateless Rohingya Muslims who have been trafficked from Myanmar and Bangladesh aboard overcrowded boats. Dozens of graves, as well as pens likely used as cages for Rohingya, have been found in abandoned jungle camps on both sides of the Thailand-Malaysian border. Times the Brief is brought to you by Squarespace. Squarespace is the easiest way to create a beautiful website, blog, or online store for you and your ideas. Squarespace features an elegant interface, beautiful templates, and incredible 24/7 customer support. Try Squarespace at squarespace.com and enter offer code THEBRIEF at checkout to get 10% off. Squarespace. Build it beautiful. It's turning into a big year for readers. Though highly anticipated releases from authors such as Jonathan Franzen and Harper Lee remain on the horizon, 2015 has already produced enough great books to topple a nightstand. To help you sort through the year's offerings or choose which titles to add to your summer reading list, Time has ranked the best books of 2015 so far. The picks span genre and form, including a darkly enchanting collection of short stories, a delightful novel featuring a dysfunctional bride-to-be, and a singing memoir chronicling both grief and, yes, taming a hawk. Happy reading! A God in Ruins by Kate Atkinson. Atkinson covers four generations of the Todd family that was at the center of her previous novel. The narrative jumps throughout the 20th century around the story of Teddy Todd, a Royal Air Force pilot in World War II who struggles with his post-war survival. Seven Eves by Neal Stephenson. When disaster dooms the planet, people across the world unite to send a coalition into outer space and ensure the survival of their species. After 5,000 years, seven races of humans stem from the survivors, and they attempt to return to a changed Earth. I Take You by Aliza Kennedy. Lily Wilder, a promiscuous lawyer in New York, prepares to marry her archaeologist fiancé, Will. The novel follows her difficulties embracing monogamy in both theory and practice, told with the inflection of Lily's humor. Get in Trouble by Kelly Link. Each of these nine stories takes place in a seemingly normal setting, such as a hotel or at a birthday party, into which dark elements of the fantastic and supernatural subtly intrude. Trigger Warning by Neil Gaiman. A collection of tales from virtuoso storyteller Nick Gaiman, ranging from horror to science fiction to fairy tales to verse. They include Adventure Story, Gaiman's rumination on death, and A Calendar of Tales, short takes inspired by his replies to fan tweets. H is for Hawk by Helen MacDonald. An experienced falconer, MacDonald resolves to train a vicious predator, the Goshawk, as a means to cope with the death of her father. This stunning memoir explores the deep, strange bond she forms with her bird. The Story of Alice by Robert Douglas Fairhurst. The Story of Alice charts the curious, controversial friendship between Oxford mathematician Charles Dodgson, more commonly known as Lewis Carroll, and Alice Liddell, the child for whom he created Alice in Wonderland. The book also explores how and why Alice in Wonderland and its sequel, Through the Looking Glass, have had such lasting cultural resonance. The Brothers by Masha Gessen. Russian-American journalist Masha Gessen's passionate, opinionated, deeply reported exploration of the long road that led Tsarnaev brothers to commit the Boston Marathon bombing. She traces the family's history from Chechnya to a precarious Boston-area immigrant demimonde, asking urgent questions and avoiding simple answers. The Folded Clock by Heidi Julewitz. Inspired by diaries from her childhood, Heidi Julewitz chronicles her daily life in this diary-form memoir that is simultaneously about small details and big ideas. How Music Got Free by Stephen Witt. Journalist Stephen Witt writes a lucid, mordantly funny account of the rise of digital music piracy, starting with the story of a worker in a North Carolina CD pressing plant who personally leaked more than 2,000 albums over 8 years. The head of the failed Japan-based Bitcoin exchange, MT Gox, was arrested in Tokyo on Saturday on suspicion of inflating his cash account by $1 million, authorities said. Mark Capellas, 30, is suspected of accessing the exchange's computer system in February 2013 and inflating his account, Japanese police said. If found guilty, the France-born Capellas could face up to 5 years in prison or a fine of up to 500,000 yen, which translates to $4,000. Capellas' lawyer said his client denies wrongdoing, the Kyoto news agency reported. MT Gox went offline early last year. Capellas said then that tens of thousands of bitcoins worth several hundred million dollars were unaccounted for and suggested they were stolen by hacking. The relationship between the lost bitcoins and the inflated account was not immediately clear. Japanese TV showed a T-shirt-clad Capellas with a baseball cap pulled low over his face being led into a police car from his home in Tokyo. Japanese authorities have acknowledged they were baffled by the MT Gox case because they had never dealt with possible crime dealing with Bitcoin. Experts also said it might be difficult to take action because of the absence of laws over virtual currencies. The Bitcoin community worldwide has been outraged by MT Gox's apparent incompetence. The MTGOX debacle served to highlight the perils of Bitcoin transactions. Bitcoins are not regulated by central banks or other financial authorities. Bitcoin proponents have long said MTGOX is just an exception. Legislation is in the works in California, for instance, to regulate businesses that hold Bitcoin and other virtual currency in a way similar to banks. New York has also issued rules overseeing Bitcoin. This article posted by Yuri Kayagama for the Associated Press in Tokyo. Taylor Swift isn't the only one crushing it with surprise celebrity guests. After rumors began circulating that Bruce Springsteen would join U2 on stage during the band's final performance at New York's Madison Square Garden, the Boss surprised the crowd with an acoustic guitar in hand. Video from inside the venue shows the iconic musician as he joined Bono on stage for a rendition of "I Still Haven't Found What I'm Looking For." The two traded lines, just as they did back in 2005 during U2's Rock and Roll Hall of Fame introduction, followed by a rendition of "Stand By Me." Despite the chatter, fans weren't assured going into this concert that Springsteen would actually show up, though Bono did leave a few clues along the way, according to Rolling Stone. He sang 6 seconds of "Hungry Heart," one of Springsteen's more famous tunes that he originally wrote for the Ramones. By the end of "Where the Streets Have No Name," an additional mic stand was in place, and everyone knew what it meant. "Earlier, when I busted myself up here in the city, we had a gig in Times Square for Red, and this man showed up and delivered," Bono said. "The chairman, the boss, Mr. Bruce Springsteen." It seems like Swift has been dominating headlines with her special guests, including Nick Jonas, Lorde, and Jason Derulo. But U2 has also been bringing famous friends on stage at shows. Springsteen joins the likes of Lady Gaga, Jimmy Fallon, and The Roots, and Paul Simon, all of whom recently guested with the band during its tour. This article posted by Nick Romano and originally appeared on EW.com. Three relatives of the late al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden were among four people killed when a private jet crashed on landing in southern England, British police confirmed Saturday. The Hampshire Police Force said formal postmortems were still being conducted, but the victims were believed to be the mother, sister, and brother-in-law of the owner of the aircraft, all of whom are from the bin Laden family. It said all three were Saudi nationals who were visiting Britain on vacation. The plane's Jordanian pilot also died. Arab media and NBC News named the relatives as Osama bin Laden's stepmother, Raja Hashim, his sister, Sana bin Laden, and her husband, Zuhair Hashim. Saudi Arabia's ambassador to Britain, Prince Mohammed bin Nawaf bin Abdel Aziz, offered his condolences to the wealthy bin Laden family, which owns a major construction company in Saudi Arabia. The embassy will follow up on the incident and its circumstances with the concerned British authorities and work on speeding up the handover of the bodies of the victims to the kingdom for prayer and burial, the ambassador said in a statement tweeted by the embassy. Police said the Embraer Phenom 300 executive jet crashed into a parking lot and burst into flames while trying to land at Blackbush Airport in southern England Friday afternoon. The plane was flying from Malpensa Airport in Milan to the airport about 40 miles southwest of London, which is used by private planes and flying clubs. No one on the ground was hurt. Police and the Air Accidents Investigation Branch launched a joint investigation. Andrew Thomas, who was at a car auction sales center based at the airport, told the BBC that the plane nosedived into the cars and exploded on impact. He said he saw the plane and several cars in flames. The plane's pilot was Mazen Salam al-Dajjah, a Jordanian in his late 50s. His brother Ziad told the Associated Press that al-Dajjah's family had been told of his death by a representative of the bin Laden family's corporation. He said Al-Dajjā received his pilot's license in California about 25 years ago and had been employed by the bin Laden family. The bin Laden family disowned Osama in 1994 when Saudi Arabia stripped him of his citizenship because of his militant activities. The Al-Qaeda leader was killed by U.S. Special Forces in Pakistan in 2011. The family is a large and wealthy one. Osama bin Laden's billionaire father, Mohammed, had more than 50 children and founded the Bin Laden Group, a sprawling construction conglomerate awarded many major building contracts in the Sunni kingdom. Mohammed bin Laden died in a plane crash in Saudi Arabia in 1967. One of his sons, Salem, was killed when his ultralight aircraft flew into power lines in San Antonio, Texas in 1988. This article posted by John Gambrell and Jill Lawless for the Associated Press in London. A customer has sued In-N-Out Burger because he says he got sick from meth he found in his milkshake. In a lawsuit filed on Wednesday in Los Angeles Superior Court, the customer, Fred Maldonado, states that he bought a banana milkshake from In-N-Out in Downey, California in March of 2014. He brought the food back to his motel room and ate it. The next morning, the suit states, he woke up and found a napkin and two capsules in the bottom of his milkshake cup. When he went back to the restaurant to complain, the manager apologized and gave him a free burger. According to the suit, later testing revealed that the capsules contained methamphetamine. Maldonado claims to have felt nausea and mental distress as a result of consuming the beverage. At In-N-Out Burger, we have always served the freshest, highest quality burgers, fries, and drinks, and customer safety is one of our highest priorities, In-N-Out Burger Executive Vice President Arnie Weisinger told City News Service. We will vigorously defend these baseless claims. This article posted by Eliza Gray. Vice President Joe Biden's late son, Beau, told his father to run for president before he died, according to a report. New York Times columnist Maureen Dowd, in her weekend column entitled Joe Biden in 2016, What Would Beau Do?, describes in great detail a conversation that Beau had with his father before dying, urging his father to run for president rather than letting the office fall to former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. Joseph Beau Biden III died of brain cancer at the end of May. Dowd's source for the anecdote is not clear from the column. Vice President Biden has been holding meetings at his Washington home to discuss the possibility of a run, according to Dowd. This article posted by Eliza Gray. Thanks for joining us. I'm Harvey Kojan, and you've been listening to the daily edition of Times the Brief. To get this sent to your inbox every morning, go to time.com/thebrief. You can also subscribe through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. I'll be back tomorrow. Until then, enjoy the day.